Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. All right, John chapter 6. All right, last week as we were working through the first part of John 6, we talked about one of my favorite stories, which is the feeding of the 5,000. There we saw there's potentially much more than just 5,000 people there. There probably could have been upwards, some scholars estimate, of 20,000 people. And so we saw that Jesus did a miraculous miracle, probably the one miracle that affected the most people all at one time, immediately at one time. Obviously, Jesus' death and resurrection obviously affects more than just 20,000 people. But at one time in Jesus' ministry, this was the most people that were affected in one fell swoop by anything that Jesus did, right? So our story today picks up what happens immediately after Jesus is done feeding the 5,000. And again, we'll kind of talk about Mark and Matthew's gospel as well, because they kind of give us a few other details that John doesn't give us. And so if you put all three of those gospels together, you have quite a full story of what happens immediately following the feeding of the 5,000. And so what we'll do is kind of what we've been doing as far as how we'll attack this verse or this passage. We'll read a few verses. We're going to read about 3.5 verses. We'll read verses 16 through the beginning of verse 19. And we'll stop and talk about that. And then we'll finish up the story. And then we'll get a couple main points and two application points today. Okay? All right. So y'all ready? All right. Here we go. John 6:16. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat and started across the sea to Capernaum. So that's a city, kind of, if you're imagine the Sea of Galilee is like a clock, and Capernaum is close to 12 o'clock, okay? The disciples and Jesus are at about 3 o'clock. That's 2:30 to 3 is where they're at on the clock, and they've got to go to Capernaum, right? So they're not going all the way across. But in some of your translations, or if you read Matthew or Mark, it might say that they're going to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. So in our mind, we think they're going over there. But the reason they call it the other side is because dead in the middle, it's two different territories. It's two different jurisdictions. So they went to the other side last week, which is the Golan Heights. This week, they're going back to the other side, which is Galilee. Okay? So if you read Matthew 6, or excuse me, read Mark 6, or you read the passage in Matthew and it says the other side, it's not literally straight across, but that's why it's called the other side. All right, so they got in boats and they started across to Capernaum. It was now dark and Jesus had not come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. And we'll read the first part of verse 19. And when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles. And we'll stop at that comma just for a second, okay? All right, so here's kind of the set of the story. Matthew and Mark give us a little bit more detail as to what happens at the beginning of this story. And they tell us, because remember, where did the story leave off? What was the end? Jesus had fed everybody, and everybody was like, wow, a miracle happened. He fed all of these people. Surely this is the prophet. We should go make him king. And you remember the crowd came up, and they were pressing to make Jesus king. Well, Matthew and Mark tell us that Jesus kind of, as that's happening, immediately takes the disciples and go and puts them in a boat. So the impression of the story gives us is Jesus says, come on, guys, y'all got to get out of here. As in, things is about to get out of hand. And so he takes the disciples, ushers them, and said, y'all go on and get in the boat. And then Mark leads us to believe that in some way, shape, or form, Jesus is going to catch up with them later. So when Jesus puts him in the boat, it's evening, it's dusk. It's not nighttime just yet when they get in the boat. And so they shove off and they go across the Sea of Galilee. Matthew and Mark tells us that Jesus goes back and says to the crowd, y'all can go home now. My interpretation, he dismisses the crowd. It's time for y'all to go, right? And so Jesus dismisses the crowd, and then the story tells us, Matthew and Mark tell us, that Jesus goes up higher into the mountains to pray by himself. Okay? So what happens? All three of the stories tell us that as the disciples are going across the Sea of Galilee, that a strong wind comes up that is contrary to them. That's the word it uses. That's the phrase. Contrary to them. What does that mean? That means, all right, remember your clock? They're at 3 o'clock and they've got to get to like 12. And so they're going this way and the wind is blowing directly against them, opposite the way. It's a headwind, not a tailwind. So it is heavily slowing them down. And you got to remember now, at least four of the disciples, Andrew, Peter, James, and John, are seasoned seafarers. They've lived and grew up on the Sea of Galilee. They had a lucrative, or I shouldn't say lucrative, they had a successful fishing business, all four of them together. Zebedee, James and John's father, was a part of that. And so they had probably several fishing vessels, probably from the time these men were boys, young boys, they had lived and grown up on the Sea of Galilee, right? So for them, for this wind to be contrary to them, and for them to have only made 3 or 4 miles that night means it was really bad. Now you say 3 or 4 miles, that sounds like a long way. Well, let me put that in context. If you go on the Sea of Galilee from 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock, it's only 8 miles total. The whole Sea of Galilee at the widest point is only 8 miles. And remember, were they going all the way across? No. They were going this way, which means the whole journey should have only taken them a couple of hours. But the story tells, and we'll read it in just a minute, in verse 20, it's going to tell us at the fourth watch of the night. Now, that didn't mean a whole lot to us, so let me put it in our time frame. That means between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. So what does that mean? That means at evening, at 6 p.m., they started out on this journey. And by 3 a.m., they hadn't even made it there yet, which should have taken them just a couple of hours. In fact, one source I read said that you could go across the 8 miles in 2 hours. So for them to have not had to go that far, and it took hours and hours until almost daylight potentially, for them, and they're not even there yet, that means the storm was really bad. Really bad. And so they're out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, and they are struggling to get to Capernaum. Now, Jesus has said he's going to catch up with them, but obviously Jesus never comes, and so they start booking it on trying to get across. That's when the storm catches up. Mark kind of alludes to the fact that Jesus is going to catch up with them somewhere near Bethsaida. Jesus doesn't do that. It becomes night. They're headed. Strong wind comes. Seasoned veteran seafarers are struggling with all their might to get to where they're going to go. Now, let's read pick up in verse 19 after the first comma. They saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. Verse 20. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." And in what might be the understatement of the century in this story, then they were glad to take him in the boat. I don't know if John could have undersold that emotion any more than just by saying they were glad to take him in the boat. I bet they were glad to take him in the boat. And immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. All right, so let's talk about this for a minute. All right, so again, Matthew and Mark give us a couple details. Jesus sees that they're struggling going across, and he starts walking across the top of the water. Now, remember, what's going on? They are struggling to get to where they're going because of why? The wind. So I don't know if you've ever been out on a lake when it's really windy. You know what happens? White caps. You know what white caps are? Is when the waves break and it looks like the ocean on the lake. It doesn't happen unless the wind is really blowing. And so it is like white capping out there. And here comes Jesus on, not in the water, but on top of the water. All right, the text is very specific. Jesus is walking on the water, meaning on the top of the water. So as the disciples are windswept, now remember, what have they been doing? They've been feeding people all afternoon. 20,000 of them. Just how long do you think that took? Then they picked up all the leftovers that nobody wanted or that were extra for themselves. And then it's evening, and then they're in a boat, and there's what they think is going to be just a short trip turns into an all-night affair, into the wee hours of the morning, and they're sitting there rowing all night. I'm tired. I need a break. So they switch out, right? And then they see something on top of the water. John says that they were, Miss McCarthy, can you go back to verse 20? John says that they were, or verse 19, excuse me. Let's go back one more. Look at the word. John says, what's the last word in the sentence? Frightened. That means they had a phobia. That's literally the word for phobia. They had a phobia. They had fear in their lives. Now, Matthew and Mark choose another word. They say they were frightened. Or excuse me, they were terrified. Terrified. That word terrified, listen to me, means to have acute mental anxiety. I imagine so. Sleepy, tired. That bread done wore off by now. And them little three-finger brim done been gone. Long time ago. They're tired, they're hungry, they're ready to get. Jeez, ain't nowhere to be found. And what happens? They see something walking on top of the water. Now, Mark tells us, Matthew tells us, they think it is a ghost. I imagine they did think it is a ghost. You ever seen anybody walk on top of the water? Have you tried to walk on top of the water? It don't work. I'm sorry. And so they are terrified, frightened. They have phobia and fear and acute mental anxiety about what's going on. They don't have a clue. But as soon as Jesus realizes that they cry out loud. I imagine they hollered and yelled and pointed and did all that kind of stuff. Jesus says, don't be afraid. It is I. Don't be afraid. And then John says, they rejoice. They gladly, yeah, I bet you did gladly take him in. When you realize it's Jesus and not some ghost out there on the ocean, right? I mean, who was the first guy that saw? Oh, I mean, I imagine everybody stopped rowing at that point and then you're just going backwards, right? But then what happens? Matthew and Mark tell us that immediately when they get Jesus in the boat, guess what happens? The wind ceases. So that doesn't mean that there's like a tail off, like it's blowing really hard and then it gradually slows down. Ceases means it immediately stops. And then all three of the stories put this little kind of weird kind of line at the end. It says, and immediately the boat was at land to which they were going. So immediately they were at port like that. And then that's how the story ends. Now, next week, we're going to pick up with what happens after this story because it's kind of getting to be daylight hours and something unique happens and Jesus gets in this long conversation. It'll probably take us 2 weeks to get through the conversation because it's a back and forth with the people who ate the bread on this side of the Sea of Galilee and are now back on the other side because they realize everybody's gone or Jesus and the disciples ain't there and they're like, what happened? Right? So we'll talk about that next week. So what's the main ideas going on in this very six-verse story? Well, I don't think, and I don't want to lose this because we picked it up last week and we're going to see it again in full force in the next couple weeks. I don't want to lose this, but there's Passover allusions even in this story today. Remember we said that last week's story about the manna and or the bread and the fish was a call back to when the Israelites were in the Passover and when they went into the desert and God fed them bread and manna from heaven. And we said that, you know, Jesus is leading a new exodus of people, not to a new physical land, but of hearts and minds and lives. Well, we see this same kind of idea played out in this story as well. Because what did Moses do? Come on, y'all watch the Easter Moses. I don't know why Moses came on to Easter, the Exodus story. Charles Heston. Yeah, I got it right. Did I get it right? Okay, well, y'all know what I'm talking about. Anyway, what does Moses do? He raises up the staff, and what happens to the Red Sea? And they all walk on dry land, right? Well, Jesus don't walk on dry land, but what's he do? He walks on top of the water, and the disciples are going from one side to the other, just like the Israelites are trying to go from one side of the Red Sea to the other side of the Red Sea, and a miracle happens and they get to where they want to go. Well, what do we see here? Jesus and the disciples are trying to get from one side to the other, and it ain't happening. Right? And what does Jesus do? He comes walking on, not on the bottom of the lake bed, but on top of the water as the white caps are bristling over, and he gets in the boat, and immediately the sea stops, and whew, they're there. So again, we see that even this miracle harkens back to the Passover, which is going to set us up for next week's conversation, and probably the next, where Jesus and the Jews get into this conversation about the bread of life, and about real bread, spiritual bread. But the main emphasis of this story is not the Passover kind of allusions, but it is absolutely Jesus' power. Specifically, Jesus' power over nature. And he shows his power over nature with three different miracles all wrapped up into this story. Right, so the first miracle is what? Jesus walks on top of the water. Clearly, I don't know if you've ever tried to walk on top of the water, but I've yet to be successful. Right? Come on, y'all have seen those videos where like the people try to ski on top of the water and then they face plant and then what do? They go under the water. I mean, you know, we've got a pool. You know, as much as you try to like walk on top of the water, it doesn't work. Like, we all eventually sink. But yet Jesus defies physics and gravity and everything and is walking on top of not a calm storm, calm sea, but a storm-ridden Sea of Galilee. And he is walking on top of it. So that's miracle number one. So Jesus defies the laws of physics and gravity. But then immediately when Jesus gets into the boat, what happens? The wind ceases. That means it immediately gets calm. So there Jesus has power over natural forces, over the wind and over the water and the waves. But then all three, Matthew, Mark, and John, all say that after Jesus gets in the boat and after the storm is calmed, the third miracle is they immediately get to where they're going. Now, we got three options of what that could look like. Okay, here they are. One, the disciples in the boat keep rowing. And they're already really close, but not made it there yet. And so now that the wind's calm, what happens? They just get there really quickly. Okay? The second option is that now that Jesus is in the boat and the waters are calm, the boat still kind of has some momentum, and so they just kind of coast in really fast. Because, you know, the boat's moving, but the water's calm now. But all three of the stories give the impression of something completely different. And look at me. I don't really know how to explain this. Okay? Because it just defies logic. All three of the stories give the impression that, here, let's do this. Let's just say the music stand is Capernaum and the disciples are over here in the boat. All three of the stories give the impression that somehow Jesus, like, crunches up the Sea of Galilee somehow. Or, like, what I mean is, here, let's use this for, I'm a visual person. So let's imagine this is the boat, okay? And they're over here, and they're, and then it goes, and then it's almost as if Jesus takes the boat and goes, boop, here we are. And they kind of miss the whole part in between where they were and where they're trying to go. It's as if Jesus teleport. That's the best word I can use. Like, it's just like Marvel Comics stuff here. Jesus, like, teleports them from where they... Now, they're close. They've gone 3 or 4 miles, so it's not far, but they're not there yet. And it's like Jesus teleports them or transports or like... just kind of subtracts all the distance between where they are and where they're trying to go, and immediately they go from where they were to where they need to be. Like that. That's what all three of the stories give the impression. They give the impression they don't coast in. There's no mention of rowing in, because John could have chosen any word he wants to. What's the word he uses in verse 21? And immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. Now, I don't know about you, but if you still got to row 200 yards, you don't get there immediately. You get there in a little bit. a whole lot sooner than you would if the wind was still going, sure. But that's not immediately. Immediately is we were here, and then somehow we got to here. Just like that. And so there's three miracles. Jesus walks on top of the water. Jesus calms the storm. And Jesus somehow, again, teleports the boat. I don't know what that looks like. It sounds pretty awesome to me. I wish I could teleport some days. And this traffic, right? Especially if you're trying to go through Atlanta. Can we just like whoop from one side to the other? And so there's three. So absolutely, this story is all about Jesus. That's the main thrust, is that we should see that Jesus has power in a multiplicity of ways. And that's becoming more evident as the weeks go on. But what does that do for us today? Well, I believe there's two very specific but very important applications from this passage that we can use in our life today. And they deal with Jesus' power. And both of them, I don't think you can read this story without at least taking into consideration these two points of application. Here's the first one. And it may sound very, obviously. But we're going to apply it to our lives. There's a huge difference in this story when Jesus isn't in the boat and when Jesus is in the boat. Right? Now, did the disciples get in the boat on their own? No. Jesus told them, go get in the boat. And in fact, Matthew and Mark almost give the impression that Jesus was like, come on, it's like herding cats, you know. Come on, y'all get in the boat. It's like kids at Walmart. No more toys. Get in the boat. Get in the boat. You know, so Jesus like putting them in the boat. So he put them in the boat and they go out and the storm comes. But when Jesus isn't in the boat, what are they going through? The storm. A bad one. A one that seasoned veteran seafaring men cannot overcome even in for hours what should have taken them a very short time. They are struggling and straining and striving against the storm. What happens when Jesus gets in the boat? Everything changes. Everything changes. The sea gets calm. And somehow they immediately teleport to their destination. Right? Now look, I don't know if you're going to go out and go boating this weekend. But all of us are going to live life this week. And you know what? Sometimes life is a lot like that Sea of Galilee. In our family, our kind of little cliche, I gave y'all one of our Southern Grahamisms the last week with the size of the brim. If you didn't catch that, we'll talk about that after church. But anyway, today, here's another one. Life can be a bear. Life can be a bear. Now, if you don't know what that means, let me give you the backstory on the Grahamism. So my granddaddy, when it would be like in July when it's 100 and we would be down at the farm working, and my dad's picked it up and I've picked it up. And so what we say is, well, the bear's going to be out there today. Now, what we mean is the heat is going to be oppressive and it is going to be dangerous. And if you're not careful, it will get you, right? And isn't that way life is sometimes? It's a bear. It can be oppressive and it can be dangerous and it can be difficult and it can be hard. And what does this story tell us? It is infinitely more hard when Jesus ain't in the boat than when Jesus is in the boat. Now look, I am not trying to sit here today and tell you and be prosperity gospel and everything's going to be great and grandiose. But I'm not trying to say the point of this story is that if Jesus is in the boat, you'll never have problems or you'll never have bad and life will never be a bear, because that's not true. But what I can tell you that is abundantly clear in this passage is when Jesus ain't in your boat, it's going to be a whole lot worse. And that in some way, shape, or form, when Jesus is in the boat of your life, when He is in your life, He will bring calm seas. And you will eventually get to the destination He's trying to take you. But one thing that's unequivocally true is that when he's not in the boat, it's going to be a whole lot more hard than when he is in the boat. Right? So there's a difference in this story. I don't think you can read the story without seeing the difference between Jesus without what happens without Jesus in the boat and what happens with Jesus in the boat. And when you have Jesus in the boat of your life, things are infinitely much better than when he's not. Now, you may still go through situations and circumstances that are difficult. And you may go through, in fact, you will go through a storm. Or should I say plural, storms with an S on the end. You will go through that. But there's a huge difference. Now, what is that difference? Well, the story tells us that too. And that's the second point of application. What is the difference that makes life much easier when Jesus is in the boat? And it's this. Jesus is the provider of peace. The provider of peace. Now, last week, we saw this same point. In fact, if you have your outline, if you're one of the people who keeps your outlines, you stuff them in your Bible, if you'll pull out last week's outline, you'll look up and see one of the application points was what? Jesus provides. Last week, we saw Jesus provided what? Bread and fish. He provided for their physical, for the crowd's physical needs. They were hungry. He provided bread and fish. And I made the point. This was one of my driving home, points for the application was, if Jesus can provide food for 20,000 people, then surely he can provide for our lives and our needs. Right? All right, so I'm not trying to rehash the same point because Jesus doesn't provide for them physically in this story. They don't need physical provision in this story. What do they need? They need provision intellectually, mentally, and psychologically. Why? Because they are out there and they've been out there for hours fighting against the storm. And what do they see? A perceived ghost. Weary and tired, and they can't even get to where they're trying to go. And something happens and they think they have seen a ghost. And in the moment of terror, and in the moment of tiredness, and in the moment where the sea is terrorizing them, even though they should be able to do this, they can't. What does Jesus say? It is I. Do not be afraid. And then what happens? And then they receive him gladly. So what does that mean? They immediately went from fear, terror, anxiety, and all the other emotions to what? Peace. And Jesus provides what they need in that moment, which is not physical satisfaction of their hunger, but it is mental peace in their life. And honestly, I don't think you can read this story without remembering all the other times in the Bible where Jesus said, do not be afraid or have no fear. In fact, the 18 times in the Bible, God or an angel or Jesus says this exact phrase, do not be afraid, 18 times. And well more than that, and I don't know how many, but a lot more than that, God speaks about fear not. I got a few for you this morning. Let me read them. Let me read them for you this morning. They're from the Old Testament all the way to Revelation. In Genesis chapter 15, I believe it is. Let's see. Excuse me. Yeah, Genesis 15:1. God tells Abraham, fear not, Abram. In Genesis 26:4, God says to Isaac, I am the God of Abraham, your father. Fear not. Numbers 21:34, God says to Moses, do not fear him. Joshua 8:1, God says to Joshua, do not fear or be dismayed. In Joshua 10:8, he says, do not fear them. In Psalm 118:6, the Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man fear? What can man do to me? Revelation 1:17, to John, God says, fear not, I am the first and the last. That's just a handful, literally a handful of the dozens and dozens of times that from Genesis to Revelation, God tells us, do not be afraid, do not fear. Now let me ask you a question. Why do you think God has to tell generation after generation after generation after generation to the present day for us as humans to not be afraid and fear not? Because that is the natural reaction of our hearts. Right? It is our natural bent to fear and be afraid. That's why God has to tell everyone from Abram to John, from Genesis to Revelation, to not fear or be afraid. That's why He has to tell us. Because it is our natural bent to be afraid. Now, let me pause right here. So we've got some young men in the room. And let me kind of tell you what God is not saying. Because there's a difference between fear, lack of common sense, and common sense. Let me give you a story, and I'll illustrate this with a story. So last weekend, not 2 days ago, but the Friday before that, I was going to build a new compost bin for our house because we've got chickens, and so you've got all this chicken litter and table scraps, and we've got a garden this year, so you're going to have all of this like leftover garden stuff. So I need something to do, build it in. So when we moved here, for some unknown reason, we brought all of this, like, it's best way to describe it is hardy plank siding. It's like cement board siding that we got for free. We had a ton of it, and so I was like, I'm not going to leave it at a house. Like, we're taking it with us. Well, it's set in the same spot for 6 years. It's on the side of our yard. You wouldn't even know it's there because there's wild blackberries in front of it. We've got kayaks in front of it. And pine straw, last fall, covered everything. And then, being the genius that I am, I put a piece of tin over the top of it, thinking, this will help. So I go over there last Friday, and I had the thought, there's going to be a snake in this somewhere. So I got me a stick, a good stick, sturdy stick, and I start, doing this. And I pull the tin off, and, I'm careful to, like, raise it up and swoosh around and stomp and beat and do all that kind of stuff to make sure if there's one close on top, it'll scurry away. And so I pull the tin off, everything's good, great. And then I start, because there's, pine straw under the tin on top of the cement board, and so I start, swooshing it around and scraping it off, and guess what I found? A snake. Not a black snake. Oh no, a copperhead. One about yay long. He was curled up, she, whatever, it was curled up. Now look, it was this long, it wasn't this long, I promise. It was about yay long. Okay, this ain't no fish story, all right? It was about yay long. And it wasn't this long. It was about yay long. And so I was like, whoo. So I ran, got my garden hoe, but it was still curled up in a circle. I couldn't see the head. I wasn't going to try to see the head. I was swinging. And so I, whoop, cut it in half almost. And the head, he swings up. So then I'm like, I'm going to aim for the head this time. Whoop, break my garden hoe in half. The handle just goes, thankfully, though, I cut it off right in front of its eyes and just cut the mouth of it off. And it's... So then it eventually dies, and then I have to go find something else to throw it in the woods. So I get another little hoe-type thing and throw it in the woods, and then I'm like, man, what is this crap? I broke my hoe. Like, what? Oh, my gosh. Anyway, so I killed the snake. Now, here's the difference. Fear would have said, I'm not going over there at all because there might be a snake over there. Or fear would have said, I'm not going back over there because I saw a snake. Or let's just burn the whole place down. Right? Now, no common sense would have said, I'm not worried about a snake. I got boots on. It'll be all right. I'll stomp on it. And ran through the blackberry bushes in the fire and just jumped in and start wheeling stuff out. That's no common sense. Common sense is there might be a snake over here, so let me be prepared. And when there is one, you just kill it, throw it in the woods, and then you go back. I finished my compost bin, right? So when God tells us, thank you, Tucker, appreciate the round of applause. All right. So when Jesus here says, don't be afraid, He's not saying, don't have no common sense. He's saying, and listen to me, this is my definition of fear. Fear is being afraid or overly afraid, nervous, or anxious about things that either have not happened yet in the future or may never happen in the future. So what is fear? Fear is, I'm afraid of what might happen, but might ain't happened yet, and it may never happen. Because you're here and you're afraid about something out there. You don't know what's going to happen in between or in the midst of or in the circumstances. You're fearful of the future, of what might happen. And it may never turn out to be that way. Look, as snaky as that place looked over there, there might not have been a snake over there. I didn't know. Now, there happened to be one and we dealt with it. That's common sense. The Bible's not saying run roughshod in there and just like do crazy stuff and, you know, jump off the bridge into the water and, you know, God's going to protect me. That's not what he's saying, right? Jesus brings peace, right? So what is peace? What is peace? Let me give you a couple ideas. Peace. Peace is not the absence of situations that in the past may have led you to fear. So peace, by Jesus bringing peace, it's not that he removes you from the potential of bad things happening or from storms, to use that language, coming up in your life. Nor does peace mean that you will be free from the emotions of negative events. Sadness, anger, disappointment, all the fear or trepidation, like nervousness. Peace doesn't mean that you will be free from the emotions that, you know, the storm of the century of your life is now, and you're like, yeah, buddy, this is joyful. I like these bad ways. That's not what peace is. So what is peace? Peace, listen to me, is a firm assurance in God's providence, grace, and mercy in the midst of the storm, in the midst of the situation. And peace means that those emotions, sadness, anger, disappointment, whatever they are tempered. That means they're pressed down to some degree by the knowledge of what Paul says in Romans 8:28. And we know that for those who love God, that's the key to this passage, that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose. So what is peace? It's not the absence of the emotions, and it's not the absence of the situation, but it is a firm knowledge of God's goodness, His greatness, His character, and His works in the midst of this situation. And it's a tempering of the emotions, knowing that for those who love God, God works together all things for their good according to His purpose. Romans 8:28. Right? Now, don't miss this one other thing, because this one little thing, and then we're going to close. And it's in Mark's gospel, in Mark chapter 6. I've got in your notes, it says Mark 4. That was a typo. If you go to Mark 4, you'll hear a great story, I'm sure, but it's not this one, okay? Now, catch this. This is not in John's telling of this exact story, okay? So we're talking about the same story, but listen carefully to what Mark says here. And he, that's Jesus, and Jesus what? Saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. Now, let's stop right there. What does that mean? Back up. Where did Jesus go to pray? The mountains. So what does that mean? Jesus could see their storm. And he saw that they were not getting to where they needed to be. And what does it say? And about the fourth watch of the night, he what? He came to them. Keep going. Walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was ghosts and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. Acute mental anxiety. What does Mark say next? But when? In a little bit? After a while? Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Now, you say, Pastor, well, that's the story we just read. Mark gives us two key things about Jesus bringing peace. What is it? Number one, he solved their situation. Jesus was not unaware, caught off guard by what was going on. He saw it, and he decided to act. But you say, but wait, he was going to pass by him. He wasn't going to stop. But he did. And when was it? When they cried out in terror. And when did he decide to step in? Immediately. So listen to me. Jesus provides peace. He provides assurance and a tempering of emotion of our emotions and assurance of God's goodness and character in the situation. But here's what I want you to see. We should never think that Jesus is unaware of what's going on in our life. We should never think that Jesus has no idea the storm you're in. And we should never think that Jesus doesn't want to get in the boat with you. Right? So, can I be just kind of honest? We're about done. About close. But this is the point where it really gets like the rubber meets the road. Because I don't know what situation of life you're in. You could be in a terrible storm in your life right now. So here's the question. Do you have peace in the storm? Do you have peace in the storm? Listen to me. If your answer is no, you know what that means? You've either kicked Jesus out of the boat or you ain't let him back in. There's a difference when Jesus is in your boat. Because Jesus brings peace in the boat with you. Now, if you're a follower of Jesus Christ and you've given your life to Jesus and Jesus is the Lord, you've been saved, you have Jesus' peace already at your fingertips. When you voice that, Lord, I need your... It's there. You've already got it. So if you're a follower of Jesus and you don't have peace in your life or in this storm or in this circumstance, that means you left Jesus on the shore. And you didn't take him with you. And worse yet, it means you ain't asked him to get back in the boat yet. Right? Because we'll when he got in the boat. Jesus brings peace. He may not take you out of the storm, but he may calm you in the storm. In fact, that's normally how it works. And he may temper your emotions in the storm because you can remember verses like Romans 8:28. And so there's no need to be fearful about things that might happen and may never happen in the future out there. But you got to get Jesus in the boat. And you got to ask him to get in the boat of your life. Because life is a bear. And it will get you. Right? So here's the question I got as we close today. Is Jesus in your boat? If he's not, friend, you need to get him in the boat today. Like, we're about to go into our response time. We're going to sing a song. Miss Kathy's going to cue us up a song here in just a second. And I'm going to ask you to respond just like I do every week. And if Jesus is sitting in your boat, don't wait till you get home because you're going to forget. And then, Lord knows, some of y'all going to be at VBS tonight and your 20 kids, they going to call. Y'all joking. Some of the class got a bunch of kids now. And your storm you thought was over, buddy, it's going to come roaring back. And you're going to end the night, woe is me. My life is terrible. And it's all because Jesus ain't in your boat. So, like, don't wait. Get Jesus. He's you got it available. We're just not using it. So ask Jesus to get in your boat.
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.